Okay, thanks to everybody for being here. And finally, I would like to invite Dr. Annette Schauen, who's going to give the first keynote speech. Mrs. Schauen is the head of the Department of International Law at the University of Amsterdam, where she's a senior lecturer and researcher. She's editor of the journal Legal Issues of Economic Integration. As an associate professor, she teaches courses in the law of European integration, the law of the internal market, and European Union law. Mrs. Schauen, I will give you the stage now. I could say much more about you, but...
Well, good morning to all of you. Is this working? Is it okay? Yeah? Okay. Well, first of all, I would like to thank the organization of this conference for inviting me to this event, because I think the questions you have identified are very challenging indeed. What I would like to do in this keynote is focus on the concept of European Union citizenship as it is now given in the treaty text and also on its shortcomings. Next to that, I hope to offer some insight into possible paths of development to deal with these present shortcomings. Now, European Union citizenship emerged out of two developments. The first one is the context of free movement. With creation of the European Coal and Steel Community, later the European Economic Community, workers, professionals, service providers, and their families started to move to other member states. This movement raised practical issues, for instance, protection of social rights, political inequality of these movers in the host society. And maybe the concept of union citizenship could solve these practical issues. But there's also a second basis for the development of union citizenship, and that can be found in the early 70s with the kickoff of European political cooperation. The desire to enhance Europe on the global stage, and attached to that the wish to develop a European identity. Now, this latter development was strengthened by direct elections for the European Parliament. However, the period of Eurosclerosis, end of the 70s, resulted again in a strong focus on economic integration and a focus on the internal markets and free movement. With the fall of the Berlin Wall, this changed, because then the fall of the Berlin Wall put the political agenda of building European Union back on stage. And it also offered an opportunity to enhance political rights, especially for the movers. Then union citizenship was formally introduced into the treaty text. However, when it was introduced, the first right that was attached to union citizenship that is explicitly mentioned in the text is the right to move and reside freely in other member states, put before rights to participate in local and European elections. If you look at the Lisbon Treaty, that treaty does not change this listing order of rights attached to citizenship. So there is really a focus on free movement. And I think this focus on free movement limits relevance of union citizenship in daily lives of a lot of European citizens. Because the basic substance of union citizenship rights is only relevant once citizens move to another member state. And once they move, they must make sure they won't be a financial burden to the host member state. So that's one limit to union citizenship. Another limit is that it is explicitly only for nationals of the member state. In principle, you can say citizenship amounts to membership of a political community. It is about rights, access, belonging to a certain community, can be seen as internal characterization for that political community. Now, if citizenship rights would include participation in political life of the state, citizenship rights for non-nationals could affect national sovereignty, and that very often is given as a reason to not make political participation and citizenship status directly available to non-nationals. So it can also be seen as an argument to limit participation rights in national elections,
also for EU citizens living in other member states. However, participation in local elections is part of union citizenship rights. So thereby, you can say it is recognized that local elections are not an expression of national sovereignty. But how about participation in the political life of the union? Why would you exclude long-term non-EU nationals, long-term third country nationals, as they are called, from the political life in the union? An argument for their exclusion, based on preservation of national identity, can be found in the rules for election for the European Parliament. Though European Parliament, strictly speaking, is not participating in the exercise of national sovereignty, the number of seats in Parliament is distributed along national lines. Member states are even allowed to restrict election rights for the European Parliament for EU citizens of other member states when the share of non-national citizens is larger than 20% in a state. Now, these restrictions, it all seems in line with the vision of the European Parliament as consisting of representatives of the peoples of the states. And that is how the European Parliament was defined. However, in the Lisbon Treaty, this has changed. Now the European Parliament is seen as composed of representatives of the Union's citizens. So it's there in the text, and I think this seems to give an opening for a development towards representation of all persons permanently residing in the territory of the Union. Still today, the condition of elector does not originate in subjection to Union law, elector for the European Parliament, but in being mostly national of a member state. Now, this additional character of citizenship to nationality is not that surprising if you put it in the context of the conceptual development. So on the one hand, union citizenship was sort of a codification of existing rights of free movement granted to nationals of member states. But on the other hand, as the basis of democratic legitimacy, at the time, citizenship could only establish an indirect link with the Union through the link with the member states, in view of the objection that some member states had of, for instance, including the word federation in the treaty, and the strong feelings against the Union becoming sort of a superstate. Therefore, member states felt nationality had to be the condition for Union citizenship. And member states determined by national law who are their nationals, and also who are considered their nationals for union purposes. Now, this is a very limited concept of citizenship, but still at the time, the Danish people already felt it was going too far. They rejected the Maastricht Treaty in the referendum, and one of their concerns was that the EU might create citizenship of the Union in the sense of citizenship of a nation state. Now, this concern was solved by adding a declaration to the treaty that the provisions on union citizenship do not in any way take place of national citizenship. In later treaty versions, this was even included in defining provisions on union citizenship. It says citizenship of the Union shall complement and not replace national citizenship. Now, the Lisbon Treaty here also has a very slight change. Instead of complement, the Lisbon Treaty defines union citizenship as being additional to national citizenship, which in my view again makes it conceptually possible, at least, that union citizenship develops into an autonomous status, which is, on the one hand, automatically attributed to nationals of the member states, but also can be given to third country nationals. So it is going to be a status independent from national citizenship as well. But of course, that doesn't mean that union citizenship will develop into a mirror image of national citizenship at union level. So I think the legal limits that are there in union citizenship seem to be defined by two main concerns. One, the concern that the union is turning into some sort of superstate that will erode national sovereignty national citizenship. However, this concern can be found in other treaty provisions as well today. For instance, there is a treaty provision that says that a union must respect the national identity of the member states. And there's a treaty provision that links national parliaments to the institutional structure of the union. But that is all the same concern. There's a second concern in the free movement provisions for union citizens, and that is the fear that the union citizenship is going to put pressure on the more generous social systems within the union, so the systems of the more wealthy member states. Therefore, the core economic citizenship rights are subjected to limits, conditions let down by the treaty and secondary union legislation. Basically, you can move as long as you do not become a financial burden on the host state system. Now, this is sort of the picture of how citizenship got its current definition in the treaty. The question is, how does this citizenship affect rights, access, belongings of individuals living on the territory of the Union? The connection to nationality gives rise to discriminatory treatment, both amongst Union citizens themselves, but also between Union citizens and third country nationals. Because nationality is the key to Union citizenship, which means that we have 27 different keys to Union citizenship, but also 27 ways to lose Union citizenship. On top of that, most citizenship rights are what I call cross-border rights. They can only be invoked by the movers. And by some, this is also considered to lead to social injustice. I would like to give you some illustrations of these discriminatory effects of citizenship. First, political rights. Now, as a citizen of the Union, you know you are allowed to vote and stand as a candidate in elections for the European Parliament. But the conditions to participate in these elections are again regulated at national level. The minimum voting age in all member states is 18 years. Only Austria has lowered this to 16 years. The age to stand as a candidate is different in the member states. Most states it's 18 years, but in Cyprus and Italy it seems to be 25 years, Romania 23 years. So there's an equality in age. That seems to be a minor concern. This inequality in age is also taken into the proposal for a citizens' initiative, which means, in fact, Austrians can participate in such an initiative as the age of 16, whereas other Europeans should be 18. But I think that's a minor concern. What is more problematic is that the citizens' initiative also can only be signed by EU nationals. Third country nationals living in the EU are excluded here. Now, where conditions for signing a citizens' initiative are again linked to national conditions for election of the European Parliament, you get effects that seem not just. For instance, the Netherlands has given EP voting rights to Dutch persons living outside the Netherlands. So people living in Aruba can vote for the European Parliament, can sign citizens' initiative, even though the European Parliament does not directly qualify as co-legislator for them. Non-EU nationals living in the Union are affected by Union legislation and are affected by actions of the European Parliament as a co-legislator, yet they cannot vote. This inequality has been signaled more than once, but so far nothing has been done about it. There is a directive on the status of third country nationals who are long-term residents. And in its preamble, this directive says, well, we have to make sure that the rights of third country nationals are as near as possible to those enjoyed by citizens of the European Union. However, the directive does not give any political rights. Now, if we look at the socio-economic rights attached to union citizenship, these are brought about especially by equal treatment of moving citizens and by specific rights. They are spelled out in the Citizens' Directive. The focus on movement may lead to results that some might consider as not fair. Citizens that move to another member state may do so with their family members, irrespective of the nationality of those family members. The Court of Justice has interpreted this right in such a way that union nationals can also have their prospective family members enter the European Union once they move to another member state. So as a result, concrete result, the Moroccan wife-to-be of a Belgian national who lives in the Netherlands has the right to enter and reside in the Netherlands. Whereas the Moroccan wife-to-be of the Dutch neighbor of this Belgian national has not this right. Another example of this effect of free movement rights only can be found in Belgium. There, a Flemish system of insurance was set up to apply in a Dutch-speaking region. It applied to everyone residing in that region and also to people living in other member states working in the region. So there's one group of people excluded. This was Belgians who are working in the region but not living in that region. You can say it is discrimination of own nationals. This case became before the Court of Justice, and the Advocate General said, well, in a case like this, union citizenship should be invoked by nationals against their own state and also against the authorities of that state in order to have equal treatment. However, the court did not follow her, insisted that union citizenship cannot be invoked in so-called internal situations. So when individuals have not undertaken any cross-border movement, there is no right there for on the basis of union citizenship. Now, access to benefits has been subject in a line of cases before the Court of Justice, for instance, on students' access to maintenance grants. And it is in this line of cases that the court has determined that citizenship is going to be the fundamental status of nationals of the member states. Also, the court has determined that students who have demonstrated a certain degree of integration can claim maintenance grants. And this can be proven, this degree of integration can be proven by a period of residence. So there's a quantitative approach. A directive on citizens' rights has the same approach. The longer one resides in a host state, the more entitlement to equal treatment one has. So there is an underlying principle of residence gives entitlements in the host society. Now, if that is the underlying norm, why not equally apply this to third country nationals in living in Europe? Another remark concerns the focus on free movement. In the context of the court's case law, students' access to benefits, also access more expensive university training, such as medical studies, several authors have signaled that as a result, taxpayers from the host state are supporting further education of students from other member states with whom they share little by way of community of interest. But this seems exactly what union citizenship is about, opening up national communities of solidarity to include citizens of other member states. However, there is a real concern here, and we must make sure that in situations like these, a right balance is found between benefits for the movers and costs for the citizens who do not move. If not, it might be that union citizenship is going to be considered an elite status. On the other hand, you can say the EU provides benefits to all citizens, not only to the movers, not only to the EU nationals. And the EU tries to make this clear to all citizens. So in this context, directives, for instance, on patients' mobilities, consumer rights have been proposed. These directives are more inclusive. They define patients, consumers, respectively, as all natural persons wishing to receive healthcare or entering into a purchasing contract. A similar inclusive view can be found in other documents as well. For instance, the Europe 2020 strategy, which is supposed to set the agenda for the European economy in the next 10 years. And then recently, the Commission published an EU citizenship report 2010, and added to that is a list of 25 actions to improve the daily life of EU citizens. However, if you go through these actions, you see that it is a combination of actions directed at EU citizens and actions directed at all citizens living in the Union. Now, how we must interpret this combination of these actions under the name of EU citizenship report is not quite clear. But I think it shows, on the one hand, that a union action affects the lives of third country nationals living in the EU, even though they are not allowed to vote. In public consultations, they can participate, and this makes their exclusion from parliamentary elections all the more inconsistent, I think. From what I have said so far, it may be clear that I do not think that nationality-based citizenship for the Union is the best model we have. What would be an alternative? One might think about citizenship tests, as several member states are nowadays using civic integration programs, courses, tests. However, if you look at these tests, they are very often exclusive, suppressing diversity, forcing people not only to learn the language of the host state, but also the society's history, institutions, values, ways of life, and sometimes people must even state that they adhere to these. And even sanctions may be applied in the event of an applicant's non-compliance. Now, I think these tests cannot be seen as a way to promote social inclusion, non-discrimination, or to promote access to rights, but they have become an instrument for either assimilation or exclusion. Tests like these, I think, are not appropriate for a union which is supposed to be founded on the values of respect for human dignity, the value of equality, and the union that is supposed to respect diversity. I think that what is more appropriate is a residence-based citizenship. For a residence-based citizenship could foster a stronger link between the Union and all those residing on its territory. So the language used in recent documents, like this Europe 2020 strategy, but also Lisbon Treaty itself, where it says that a union shall offer its citizens an area of freedom, security, and justice, and the union shall contribute to protection of its citizens, seems to go in that direction. The fear of member states that they will lose their national identity now has been met by other treaty provisions, which stipulate that the union will respect the national identity of the member states. It also has been respected by the role national parliaments are given as guardians of subsidiarity. And I think perhaps the inclusion of these other provisions makes it easier to let go of nationality as a key to union citizenship. I thank you.